miss catching somebody's questions in the Q&A or whatever, just jump right in. Don't be bashful.
Yeah, I'm going to help monitor those questions. Yeah, and see, it's, you know, see, depending on how many we have and how many are repetitive, I'll try to help, you know, sort out which ones have already been answered. And I could take a peek at the chat box too. Sure.
So I think one of the things is on this agenda, based on the ad hoc committee meeting stuff, that we still got quite a bit of time under the discussion for the potential SNC criteria. And, you know, a shorter time there with Tony's presentation. So that time may switch some, right, Tony? Or are you going to just roll in and be presenting some of that discussion on the SMC, just kind of flow through there? Is that the intent?
Yeah, I think just keep flowing through it and get to the end and then entertain questions. Hopefully we'll be getting questions along the way. And then we can make a decision, I think, on the spot as to whether that's a director question or a board question or something you want the technical team to answer.
Hi, everyone. I just want to interrupt. I've got 9 attendees getting into our meeting or joining our Zoom meeting. Our directors were just talking about some schematics as to what we're going to be doing for the meeting. So you have not missed the beginning of the meeting. We were just asking some questions before we start. I just wanted to make sure people knew that. So we will start momentarily.
Good evening, all.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Hello, Ed.
I was just able to get on. I started at 11:45, but wasn't able to join.
Maybe you're joined as an attendee versus a panelist.
Well, that could be. I tried going through the proper channel and couldn't get it, so I tried everything else and this worked, so here I am.
You're good. You're in the panelist.
Yay.
Yay.
You guys hear me? It's a quick question. I see an Abby. I'm looking at the wrong menu.
We have now 14 members of the public on. Thank you very much. We will be starting momentarily for the Fillmore Piru Groundwater Sustainability Stakeholder Workshop. And what's really nice is that everyone has their name listed, so that'll be great for attendance. Okay. Do we have any, Zach, do we have any more that need to be let in?
It's fully open. You guys are ready to roll.
Okay, thank you. I know that time is extremely valuable to people. And so I would like to say thank you to all those that are attending us today for the Fillmore Piru Groundwater Basin Sustainable Agency. We are holding our second or multiple stakeholder workshops. Today's meeting, I just want to say thank you very much for attending. My name is Kelly Lung. I'm a Ventura County Supervisor for District 3. Which is part of the district is Fillmore and Piru. And I am also your chair for today, so I'll be your host. We also have our board members that are online. And if I could just go through for the Pumpers, Piru Pumpers Association, if you could introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Glenn Pace, and I represent the Piru Pumpers Association as part of the board.
And our representative from the Fillmore Pumpers Association.
Hello, I'm Gordon Kimball, and I represent the Fillmore Basin Pumpers Association.
Thank you. And our environmental.
Hi, I'm Candace Minigan with I'm on the board of Friends of the Santa Clara River, but I represent a conglomerate of environmental stakeholders on the Santa Clara River, representing groundwater dependent ecosystem considerations.
Thank you. And then representing City of Fillmore.
Hi, good evening. This is Tim Holmgren. I'm the mayor of Fillmore and pleased to be here tonight.
And our member representing United Water.
Good evening. I'm Ed McFadden. I represent District 1, United Water Conservation District. District 1 encompasses most of the east end of the Santa Clara River Valley.
Thank you very much. And our executive director.
Good evening. Tony Emmert, executive director. My day job is working for United Water Conservation District, and I'm privileged to work with the Fillmore and Piru Basin GSA in spare hours.
And our clerk.
My name is Eva Ibarra, and I work for United Water.
Thank you. And then our consultants.
Good evening. I'm Tony Morgan with Daniel B. Stevens and Associates.
Good evening. I'm Lisa Ballin with. Lisa Ballin with the Sacramento State Collaboration and Consensus Program.
Thank you. And Patrick?
Yes, and my name is Patrick O'Connell. I'm a hydrogeologist with Daniel B. Stevens.
Thank you very much. I wanted to make sure that our public knows who is a part of our board and our consultants and so forth. Please note that this meeting is being recorded and will be presented on our Fillmore Piru Groundwater Sustainable Agency's website at any time, so you'll be able to have access to that. Also, all of our information that we've had from our board meetings, all the details of our last stakeholder workshops are also on that website. So I want to make sure if there anyone misses anything or wants to get more information, please go to fpbgsa.org, and you can go there for the information. Ed, I'd like to pass this. What's the other questions? I guess at this point, I'll pass it to Ed, if you could just make some comments of why we're here.
Sure, Chairman Long. So this is part of an ongoing program where the GSA is reaching out to all stakeholders to make sure that everybody's fully involved, has a chance for input, and is a requirement that we have a robust outreach program to all stakeholders concerning this GSA. So tonight we're going to dig more into what we're calling sustainable management criteria. Those are important factors that we'll use as we move forward to put together the groundwater sustainability plan as required by the Department of Water Resources, State of California, as for SGMA. We'll try to have a review, educate everyone, answer questions. There'll be some polls involved. And then we'll also have a financial review, look at the budget and schedule and how things are going and what is out there. And there's quite a bit to do. We've got a heavy agenda tonight. We've got a heavy agenda for the next 2 years. Let's dig into it right now. And Chairman Long, our Chairperson Long, if it's okay, I'll go ahead and introduce Tony Morgan to talk about sustainable management criteria.
Well, if we could just to make sure to get everyone who is Zoom friendly or not, if you have questions during the presentation, if you could put it into the chat for everyone, therefore we can answer those questions for you. I do not see anyone who's joined the phone online with a phone, but if you want or have a question, you need to raise your hand, you would press 9. And so I wanted to make sure that you put your comments in the chat so we can document it and have it for our records. And then also I'd like to have Lisa talk about our polling as we do our presentations, how people can engage in this presentation. So Lisa.
Thank you, Chair Long. Good evening. So as part of tonight's workshop, we have two polls planned. The first will be at the outset of the meeting and the second at the conclusion. So the purpose of the first poll, which Zach is going to launch in a moment, is just to help us get a sense of your groundwater interests, as well as your familiarity with SGMA and the sustainable management criteria terms. The results of this poll will help our presenters tailor their discussions according to, you know, your interests and your level of prior information. The answers that you provide will be anonymous, just so you know. So the poll is up now. We'll give you a few minutes to fill in your answers. You simply click on the answer that you feel is most appropriate. And then when we've got our results, Zach will post a summary and we can get a sense of who we've got and what your interests are.
And just to let people know, we have 18 attendees and the hosts and panelists cannot vote on this poll.
So Zach, whenever you feel like you've got...
You're about 30% right now.
Okay, so we'll give it another minute. And also just to clarify a little bit, we've got a Q&A feature at the bottom, and that's a good place to put questions when you're listening to the presentations tonight. If you'd like to use the chat as well, we'll be checking both.
And also this survey with the Department of Water Resources and SGMA, we are very much to, the instructions are to be engaged with our community and know who is coming to the stakeholder engagement workshops to make sure we're engaging everybody. So having you fill out this poll is very helpful for us.
All right, we're about 2 minutes into the poll. It looks like we have an 88% participation. So I'm gonna go ahead and end the poll here. If you haven't had a chance, apologize. And any moment now, you guys should see the results of this.
Okay, super. So it looks like we've got a pretty good split. Fillmore, Pyru, both, as well as other. We've got a strong majority of agricultural groundwater interests with a good showing from the environmental interests as well, some domestic and municipal. Okay, we've got about half, a little more than half attended the first workshop, so there's some good familiarity with SGMA background, and we'll bring up the rest of the 44% today, hopefully. As similar to the concepts of the sustainable management criteria. Okay, so that's good to know. Some of you have heard these terms already, so it won't be new for all of you. And a good showing from the Pumpers Association. And thank you for telling us how you heard of this meeting. So we hope to reach out in the ways that are most effective. So with that, I'll turn it over to get rolling with the content of this evening's presentation. Tony Morgan is gonna give us a presentation that first defines these terms, these sustainable management criteria definitions that are used in SGMA. And once we get through that and set that foundation, he'll present some potential criteria that the board has been considering and really wants some input from stakeholders on.
Good evening, everyone. Again, Tony Morgan here with Daniel B. Stevens and Associates. I'm a principal hydrogeologist with that organization, and we're going to run through some background material here quickly at the beginning on sustainable management criteria, just to make sure everybody's up to speed on some of the terminology. Like any regulation that we get out of our friends from Sacramento, it's filled full of jargon and has its own set of acronyms that go with it. So we're going to briefly go through that. There was a significant number of you in the poll that didn't that weren't familiar with some of the terms. So let's just take a few moments and go through those, and then we'll jump into some more meaty issues as we get going.
Can I interrupt for just a minute? I noticed we have one hand raised, and I just want to make sure if that's a question on and on the kind of what we've already discussed about. So okay. It was just, oh, did the hand, oh, I think the hand went down. So never mind. I guess we're good.
Okay. If they want to raise their hand again later, no problem. No problem. I have multiple screens going on here tonight. So if I look back and forth and I'm not looking at you in the camera, I'm not trying to avoid you. I'm just bouncing back and forth between screens with different information on it. So sustainable groundwater management criteria. Well, where did this all come from? It came from the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, commonly called SGMA. It's a state law, requires the management of high and medium priority groundwater basins to ensure their sustainability into the future. And that's the situation where we are. We fall into those categories. And so we're required to do that. So how does this Sustainable Groundwater Management Act get implemented? Well, local groundwater sustainability agencies are responsible for preparing and implementing the groundwater sustainability plan, okay? And the Fillmore and Piru Basins GSA was formed to provide that local control over the SGMA compliance in the Fillmore and the Piru Basins. And so they're their local agency that gives us the local control. The state of California, if we don't assume local control and manage the basins satisfactorily, the state has the ability to come in and take over the basins and do the management their way. So we prefer to have this done locally. Locals know better how the system can be managed. They're more familiar with it than the state of California is. And so the GSA was formed and we're in the process of working our way through the formulation of the GSP. So what is sustainability? Like I said, there's all kinds of lingo and buzzwords associated with it. So there's a phrase, sustainable groundwater management, and that's management of the use of groundwater in a way that it's maintained during the planning and implementation horizons without causing undesirable results. So you'll see this term undesirable results popping up very frequently during our discussions this evening. So if you think about what you see in the first paragraph here, sustainable groundwater management is not a number. It's the absence of undesirable results. So sustainable groundwater management is without causing undesirable results. So it's not a number. But we can determine what the sustainable yield of the basin is, and that can be a number. So sustainable yield means the maximum quantity of water that you can extract from the basin over a base period. A base period generally means something, a multi-year type condition. It usually is 1, 2, maybe even 3 decades long is a base period. And so whatever that base period is, it's representative of the long-term conditions, the ups and downs in the climate, the drought periods and the wet periods, okay? They wanna know what's the maximum quantity of water that can be withdrawn without causing that undesirable result. In other words, think of the undesirable result as a bad thing. How much water can we take out of the basin before bad things can occur? So how is DWR going to assess our progress towards that sustainability goal? And how do we know what we're supposed to be considering? Well, there are things called sustainability indicators, and you see them going down the left here. And these are affectionately called by us in the business, the 6 deadly sins of SGMA. You don't want to cause undesirable results from lowering groundwater levels or depleting surface waters or degrading water quality or inducing subsidence or seawater intrusion or having a significant and unreasonable reduction of groundwater storage. And so SNU here means significant and unreasonable. So significant and unreasonable degradation of water quality, a significant and unreasonable depletion of supply due to lowering of the groundwater levels. It doesn't mean that groundwater levels can't change, that they can't go down, but they're asking us to determine what's the significant and unreasonable factors associated with that, that if those two come together, we end up with an undesirable result that they're going to want us to try to mitigate. So how do you put this together? It's really a pyramid, and I'll It's not a pyramid scheme. It's just a pyramid. So we start out at the bottom. Here are our six deadly sins down here, lowering groundwater levels, reduction of storage, et cetera. And you figure out, we figure out. That means stakeholders, board of directors, everyone figures out what's significant and unreasonable. What are those undesirable results that we're trying to avoid? And we come up with a metric. How are we going to measure that undesirable result? We can come up with a sustainable yield. Once we nail these down, we come up with a sustainable yield. They were, again, avoiding those undesirable results. We have 20 years to get to sustainability. We don't have to do it overnight. We've got some time to achieve it. So in our case, our plan's gonna go in January of 2022. And we have till January 2042 to achieve our sustainability. You're going to implement your GSP, practice good sustainable management practices, and that will get you to hopefully your sustainability goal. So you're going to have to maintain those conditions in your basin without causing undesirable results over a 50-year period. So you've got 20 years to implement, and they want to see that you can do it for another 30 years beyond that. So it's a 50-year period overall. Okay, so let's dig into this significant and unreasonable phrase a little bit more. It's not defined in SGMA. It's not defined in the regulation. It's defined by your local GSA. They decide what is significant and unreasonable. And this is the basic element of local control inherent to SGMA. When the regulations were being crafted early on, there were people who said Sacramento should tell everybody in the state how to do it. And there was obviously significant pushback on that. And the concept of local control won out. And so that then hands the baton for figuring out what significant and unreasonable mean to the local entities, those GSAs and the stakeholders that are a part of those various basins around the state. You'll hear the phrase minimum threshold. That's a numeric value for each indicator that's used to define the undesirable results. So let's pick an easy one. Let's say groundwater elevation, groundwater level. If the water levels in the basin fall to a certain degree and undesirable results begin to happen at that point, that elevation where those undesirable results occur is your minimum threshold. It's the minimum threshold. We go below the minimum threshold and undesirable things begin to happen. Bad things begin to happen, okay? It's a quantitative value, okay? And it cannot be an arbitrary number. And there are a few GSPs that were submitted to DWR already, those from the critically overdrafted basins, where we're hearing rumblings that some of them didn't do a very robust job of determining a non-arbitrary minimum threshold. So DWR is expecting for you to say, well, what undesirable results are you avoiding by establishing this particular minimum threshold? On the other side of the scale is your measurable objective. So it's a specific quantifiable goal. Think of it as your desired future conditions. What would I like for the basin to look like in the future? What groundwater levels do we want? What water quality do we want? Okay, this is the value that DWR is going to use. Well, let's say one of the values that DWR is going to use to monitor your progress towards sustainability in the basin. So you've got your MT, which is your minimum threshold where if it goes below that, undesirable results can occur, but you've got a measurable objective above that. That's sort of your goal. That's where we want to get to in the basin. So if you look at this in sort of a cartoon manner, we've got our indicators across the page here, and then we've got this little yardstick or ruler within there. And so for each one of these, we're going to have to establish our minimum threshold and our measurable objective, and we have to figure out a metric. How are we going to measure them? Are we going to use total volume of storage reduction? Are we going to use a rate of subsidence? Are we going to use the volume of surface water depletions or something else? We're free to pick other metrics as long as we justify how they help us quantify our ability to understand sustainability and to get to a sustainable condition in the future. So that's a real quick overview of the major terms and lingo that you're going to hear me talking about through the balance of the evening here. Do you want to stop for questions at this point, Lisa? Is there anything in the chat box that we need to?
I think this is a great. Okay. So far I don't see any hand raised, and I see one question in the Q&A. Oh, will the PowerPoint be available on your website? And the answer is yes, as well as a recording of this meeting. So thanks for asking that.
Correct. Anyone else?
I don't see.
Go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, all right, then. Let's move on. Then let's move on to our next one. So we're going to talk about potential sustainable management criteria for the basin. The board of directors of this GSA spent a significant amount of time crafting guiding principles that provide a foundational support for the operation of the agency and memorialize the basic elements. You can think of them as the beliefs of the agency about the mission of this agency. And you can see a full listing of the guiding principles here. There's a link on this slide. You can go to them. They're on the agency's website. Several of the guiding principles directly deal with the achieving of sustainable groundwater conditions. And I put a few of those representative goals here. And so you can see that they are pretty encompassing, and the board took the development of these guiding principles very seriously when they were going through. There was a lot of discussion and back and forth on them. So I'm not going to read through all of them there. They'll be available in the slides after the presentation, but this is a pretty fundamental part of it. And I would encourage you to go onto the website and check out the guiding principles. It really does tell you about the level of seriousness that the directors take their responsibilities in the GSA. So the ad hoc committee of the board has been meeting with the consultant team to discuss how sustainability would be defined in these basins. To put it simply, we need to fill out this matrix. And we need to determine what the undesirable results are for each of these indicators. Okay. From that, we'll figure out how we're going to measure them, what's our metric, what's the MT that's going to dictate when these undesirable results occur. Okay. And then what do we want our desired future conditions? What are those measurable objectives going to look like? So again, sustainability is defined as the absence of these undesirable results. And the completion of this matrix is probably the most meatiest set of decisions that the board and you, the stakeholders, have to come up with to build the GSP around. These are really foundational elements to it. And so the ad hoc committee and the consultant team have been batting around ideas. So what's the general workflow that we've been going through? Well, the consultant team has been working with the ad hoc committee right now, bouncing around ideas, brainstorming on various ways that the various sustainability criteria could be quantified. There's an opportunity here this is this evening, where the ad hoc committee and the technical team can share information with stakeholders. Stakeholders give feedback to the ad hoc committee. This continues on as this topic advances and goes to the board of directors, where stakeholders can provide input and the directors and the board of directors can provide input and thoughts back to stakeholders as well. And so this is one of the things that Sigma is very big on, is to having the ability for stakeholders to participate in the discussions and assist the board by sharing their opinions, expertise, their ideas, maybe just the perspectives is the grander way of saying it on how sustainability should be envisioned for these basins.
Tony?
So tonight, yes.
There's one question that I think would be good to address before we get a little further. The question is, okay. What is the difference between groundwater elevation and groundwater storage reduction? Aren't they tied together?
You are correct, whoever asked the question, they are tied together. And elevation is just a decline in the water elevation in the basin. Obviously, that decline in groundwater elevation means that we've lost that water that's in the aquifer. So we've got a reduction of storage. That's a volume, this is a level. So think of it as how much did the water level go down in a well during the last drought? And then if you expand that and look over the entire basin, that decline in water level resulted in the loss of how much groundwater in storage. Does that help? Okay, so tonight we're gonna take a look at groundwater elevation. We're not gonna have time to get through every one of these this evening. There will be additional opportunities in the future to weigh in on these as we come back with additional thoughts on undesirable results, et cetera. So this, I think, is a reasonable place to start with groundwater elevation, as there are many groundwater pumpers in the basins, and they're very concerned about what's going to happen with groundwater levels in their wells across the basin. And I think this is a fine place to start with. So we all experienced a recent significant drought that extended from about 2011 to 2016. So what are some of the effects of that drought and how might we quantify those effects? So let's look at a few maps here to help orient you a little bit. So we're looking here at the Fillmore Basin on this side of the map and the Piru Basin on this side of the map. This is the LA Ventura County line over here on the far right, Lake Piru up here in the corner, Santa Paula just off to the left here. So we get you oriented a little bit. Now that maybe this will help. Sespe Creek coming in there, Piru Creek coming in here. So we're fortunate that United Water Conservation District and the County of Ventura monitor water levels in several wells across each of these basins. All wells are not monitored. However, there's a fair number of them that are. The dots you see on there are color-coded, and the dots represent the lowest water level measured in the wells in 2016, which was about the peak of the drought, the most recent drought that we experienced. So we see some basic general trends here. We see along the Santa Clara River, we've got blues and greens. So generally water levels are less than 100 feet at that point. We've got some areas right here along Piru Creek and around the town of Piru where those water levels were between 150 and 250 feet down. We've got some here over 250 feet in the west end of the Fillmore Basin. So it gives you an idea of how much the water levels decline. They're not constant across the basin. It varies by where you are. If we look at it from this way, we say, what was the effect of the drought though? So if we take 2011 water levels and look at the difference between that and 2016 when there's below, we get an idea of how the most recent drought affected water levels in the basin. And so we see a slightly different pattern in the coloring of the dots here. So we see things that are red and orange in the Piru Basin, and those colors sort of go to tan and orange and even yellow as we get into the Fillmore Basin. So we can say water level decline was more severe in general in the Piru Basin than it was in the Fillmore Basin. So another way to quantify the impact of the drought is to take a look at the lowest water level and compare that to the top of the well screen in the various wells. So what do I mean? If you're not familiar with terminology around wells, here's my cartoon drawing of a well. So here's your well casing. You've got your well screen down here at the bottom. You've got a static water level. And we're talking about the difference between this 2016 level and the top of the well screen. So what's the height of this water column that's there? So that's additional water that could be extracted, drawdown that could be incurred in the well before achieving those levels moving down into the well screen. In general, you don't want your water levels falling into your well screen. You don't want your pump intake installed in your well screen. In general, you could still do it. You can pump water, but just best management practices is generally you don't want to do that. So what we're showing here on this map, and let's just take an example. Let's take this well right here, this yellow circle. It says 30. So what it's saying is that for this well, there's a water column that's 30 feet high in there. The static water level is 30 feet above the well screen. Okay? And so we have them all across the spectrum here. We've got some triangles here, monitoring wells that actually went dry. Okay? We have some domestic wells here where water levels fell into the screened interval, but they weren't reported as being dry. There was one dry agricultural well, and it was over here. So we can see that by and large, there wasn't a lot of apocalyptic effects from that drought. The other way to look at it, and this has been an effort that's been put forth in many other GSPs, is to look at the total amount of water in the well. So going from the static water level all the way to the bottom of it. Because you could pump this water that's down here in the well screen with the appropriate pumping setup. But what does that height of column of a water column look like? And so you can see it's a larger number. Again, there were still some dry wells. These are the monitoring wells. No one's drinking that water. It's purely there for measuring groundwater elevations at various times in the basin. So you can see these numbers are larger. There's a lot more water in the well before it goes dry. So let's take those various maps and boil them down into this summary table right here. And so we've carved out the various well types. So there's municipal wells, agricultural, domestic, and monitoring wells here. And the first column to the right of that shows how many of those had water levels below the top of the well screen in 2011. And in 2011, the groundwater conditions in the basin were pretty healthy. Okay, it was near full conditions in many of the wells. We examined the various hydrographs. And so we see even in 2011, there were a few wells where the water levels were already below the top of the well screen. But as the drought progressed, we see a few more, excuse me, got added to that list. So didn't affect municipal wells, but did affect a few agricultural wells. Yes, it got to some domestic wells and some more monitoring wells. Some of those where the water levels fell below the top of the well screen got within 30 feet of the total depth of the well. So the water level almost went below the bottom of the well. It was within 30 feet of that. And so we've got a couple of wells that fall into that category. But interesting enough, if we look at the dewatered wells, by dewatered wells, I'm using that phrase to reference wells where the static water level dropped below the bottom of the well. So it doesn't matter what you do, you can't pump that well. There's not any water in it. And so we had one agricultural well and some of the monitoring wells. So this gives us at least an inkling of the level of severity of what the drought did to groundwater conditions in the basin. And this 2011 to 2016 drought was a severe drought, make no doubt about it. I'll show you a hydrograph later on that kind of puts it into a little bit of more perspective.
Tony, that might be a good
yes, ma'am.
Point to address this. And it sounds like maybe you're getting to it, but in case not, we have one question that asks, okay, how much have the water levels recovered since the drought?
That depends on where you are. And in places, they've come up 50, 60 feet. Other places, a little bit less than that. And I'll show you a hydrograph that shows you the sort of bouncing around of the recovery since then. Okay. So what we'd like to do tonight is walk through more of a discussion of some possible undesirable results that we may want to consider. These are things that have been bounced around by the ad hoc committee. Nothing's been decided. These are just things that we bounced around. And so I've got them listed here as option 1, 2, and 3. And so we're going to take a look at dewatering existing wells, if that's our definition of an undesirable result. We're going to fill in the box here with some pros and cons. We're going to do the same thing with water levels dropping below the top of the well screen, and likewise for lowering the pumping equipment. So the key is to get to this pros and cons. So option 1, we're gonna dewater the existing well. So here's my cartoon well again, static water level. Your pump is sitting, pump bowls are sitting here, your pump intake is there, the well screen's down here at the bottom of the well. And when we're dewatering the existing well, what are we talking about? We're talking about that. The water level falls below the bottom of the well. You cannot pump that well. There's no water in it anymore. Okay, that's a very straightforward, and I would think for most people, they would think that's a pretty serious condition to occur, to have no ability to pump their well. Okay, that's the easy one. Let's go to option number 2. Water levels dropping below the top of the well screen. So here we are with our cartoon well again. We've got the static water level. Here's how much the water level declines when you turn the pump on in the well. Again, pump bowls, intake, and well screen. So what we're talking about is this situation where the water levels fall below the top of the well screen. If you're gonna continue to use that well, you're gonna be lengthening the column pipe here. You're gonna be extending your pumping equipment deeper into the well. Okay, so it's a situation where you're gonna spend a little money to lower your pumping equipment in the well to be able to continue to use this well with the new lower water levels. If we look at lowering the pumping equipment scenario, so we're back to our sort of base case right here, and let's just say water levels go down a bit, well, you're gonna have to lower your equipment some, but not as deep as in the other alternatives. And so that's sort of a middle of the road between the two other conditions there. So let's think about the pros and cons, and I've thrown some in here. There's probably some more that we could think of if we chewed on them a little bit. So let's look at option 1, dewatering the existing wells. If that's our undesirable result, well, what's the pros associated with that? Well, it's pretty easy to measure and monitor. I'm pretty confident the board would hear from several of their constituents if water levels were beginning to fall below the bottom of the wells and people couldn't pump. The total depth of the well data are available for most wells in the basin. So we've got something that's relatively easy to quantify. It's easy to monitor. You just measure the water level in the well, okay? But what's the cons? If this is a situation where we're dewatering wells in the basins, that means pumpers cannot use their well. They're gonna need a new, deeper well. They're probably gonna have to destroy the existing wells. That's general county code to do that. And they're likely gonna need new pumping equipment on top of that because their well's going to be deeper. So there's a significant cost variable associated with this particular option for an undesirable result. So let's go to the next one. Water levels dropping below the top of the well screen. Okay, once again, it's easy to measure and monitor. We've got top of the well screen data for many wells in the basins, not all, but for many. And even if that happens, it's likely that most people can continue to pump their groundwater. Cons for this, it's likely there's going to be some cost to lower the pumping equipment, maybe some increased pumping costs if that water level is now significantly lower than what you were used to before. If it's much different, if the groundwater elevations are much different, then there may be new pumping equipment. So the key here is sort of the teeter-totter question. If you were to say to folks, here's the proposition. If you're willing to lower your pumping equipment, And in return, you can continue to pump without a groundwater restriction. Is that something you as a stakeholder are willing to do? And we, as your technical consultant, nor the board, can't necessarily answer that for you. You stakeholders need to help us understand that. So if you had to lower your pump and incur that cost in exchange for being able to continue the pump without groundwater restrictions, groundwater extraction restrictions, is that something you're willing to do? The third option here is lowering the pumping equipment. Pros on that, it's easy to measure what the water levels associated with that. You can continue to use your well. You don't need a new well necessarily for that. The cons are pretty substantial here. The first one is the pump setting data are not readily available. We don't have that in our database. And if we were to try to use this as a undesirable result, we would have to go pretty much individual to individual and try to get this information from them. There still might be some costs to lower your pumping equipment. There might be some increased pumping costs as the lifts are more. Depending on what equipment you have, you might have to buy some new equipment to allow you to continue to pump water at the rates that you're accustomed to. So again, this is a situation where if we're going to be able to allow you to pump groundwater without an allocation, without a reduction of what you're doing, but it's going to cost you some money to get the pumps lowered in your well, is that something you're willing to do? Now, the cost to lower this equipment, what are those? Those vary substantially, and part of the variable that carries the most weight is what kind of well is it? If it's a municipal production well, larger casing, larger pumps, motors, etc., then putting on another 40 feet of column pipe to that that's easily a $25,000 adventure. If you're a domestic well with a small submersible pump, maybe it's a few thousand dollars to do that. So it really depends on what kind of well you have.
Okay. Tony, we have a couple of questions.
Surely.
Okay, the first one is, are the wells that dewatered shallower than the typical wells in the basin? Similar question for the wells that had water levels below top of screen. Are the screens in those wells shallower than typical wells?
Are the wells that dewatered shallower than typical wells? Yeah, most of the wells that dewatered were monitoring wells, so yes. And most of the wells, I have to think that through. I think most of the wells that where water levels fell into the screens were shallower wells. I can look up the actual numbers for you, but I believe that's a correct statement.
Okay, the next question is there data available that ties groundwater elevation to available surface water?
Only in general. Remember, most of the reach of the Santa Clara River is dry many months of the year. And during those dry months, that water table beneath the river is detached from the stream bed. So it's down, maybe it's 30, 40, 50 feet below the stream bed, depending on where you're looking. In areas where there's an elevation and surface water confluence are at the basin boundaries where we have rising groundwater occurring. So at the Fillmore-Piru boundary and at the Santa Paula-Fillmore boundary on the west end of our area. So in those areas, we have rising groundwater and we know that there's surface water, groundwater interaction associated there. But in a lot of the other segments of the river, it's dry most of the time. And even when there's storm events, there's a lag period between when surface water runoff is running down the Santa Clara River to when it actually soaks in and reconnects with the detached water table surface below that.
We also have a third question.
Sure.
Are perfs the same as Wellscreen? If so, how can you conclude anything substantial when not all wells are perforated the same? How are you accounting for perfs that are clogged?
Okay, so perfs is lingo for well screen. Okay, so we can assume that those are synonymous. Same difference there, as they say. How can you conclude anything substantial when not all wells are perforated the same? So what we're setting the framework for here is that how much of a water level decline does it take to impinge on the performance of the wells? So dropping the water levels into the well screen might cause that well to produce less water. It might not, but it can, okay? Obviously, if the water levels declined far enough that they fell below the bottom of the well, then that well produces no water. So we can take a look at the general changes in the groundwater elevations across the basins and compare those to the typical water wells in that area and get an idea as to whether a certain amount of water level decline in a drought is likely to cause an undesirable result. So that's the premise of the analysis or the data that we were walking you through just for the last few moments.
Tony, can I ask you this? There was one more in the chat.
Yes, ma'am.
It said, what is the difference between groundwater elevations and groundwater storage reduction? Aren't they tied together?
Yeah, that's the comment we went over right at the beginning. So groundwater elevation is just that. It's the elevation of the groundwater surface in the well. Storage reduction is an amount. So if we lower the water table from here to here, we can calculate how much groundwater was in there. That's your reduction in storage. So when we reduce the groundwater elevation from 50 feet, for example, to 100 feet, we can calculate what that groundwater storage reduction would look like. So it's two different things.
I also have another question.
Yeah.
Do we know which wells that if a large or complete production decrease occurred, would not have an alternative water supply?
I don't imagine that many of the agricultural wells have a built-in alternative water supply. It's certainly possible, and I've seen it in other basins where there will be neighbor-to-neighbor emergency connections. This well over here has water, but this well over here is dried out. And so they'll have emergency hookup and they'll share a well for a period of time. Remember that the basin is largely dependent on groundwater for its supply, so there's not an extensive surface water connection for most of the groundwater extractors in the basin.
Director McFadden, I think, has his hand up.
Yes, Tony, two comments. One, regarding alternate supplies, many operations have several wells and intertide systems mm-hmm. to size, and so that there are ways to get around having a single well go down. I also wanted to make a comment. We're very fortunate in our basins in that the number of wells that were dewatered, if you look at the slide a couple of slides ago, and mm-hmm. wells that water below the top of the screen, it's a very small percentage of the total numbers of wells that are in the basins in spite of going through the worst drought in modern history. So we've got a pretty good situation here. I think we have to keep that in mind too. We've got a lot of health to the basin.
Very good, that's correct. Right. Was there another question?
No, you're good.
Okay. All right, then let's jump on to our next slide here. I want to take a little bit of time to talk about groundwater storage reduction. It's been interesting. It was part of a question early on. And so let's take a look at that variable a little bit. And so I threw in one groundwater storage reduction option, and we can think of others if we wish to and evaluate those. But let's just run with this for the moment to get the idea of what we're talking about. So what if our undesirable result was something to the effect of there was inadequate groundwater storage to last through a multi-year drought without groundwater extraction limitations? Okay. So what kinds of things would we want to look at if we're going to assess that? Well, we're going to look at what kind of groundwater reserves are needed to withstand a future drought. Okay, have production wells ever gone dry? We've already taken a look at that this evening. Average and depths and those kinds of things with various wells, we've got that information for us. We didn't look so much at impacts on pumping costs yet. And you know, what are the historical trends? What are the water year types? By water year types, they mean, is it a wet year? Is it a dry year? Is it an average year? That kind of thing. And what kind of projected water use do we expect in the future in the basin? And so we're working on the water use for the future right now. So here's a hydrograph. And what's a hydrograph? It basically just, it's a graph showing groundwater elevation versus time. And so this well is in the Piru Basin, and I use it because it's got a fairly long record. It goes back to 1950, goes all the way out to current. Groundwater surface is here with this, I guess it's an orange color on my screen. And what we see is periods when the basin is full or fuller, you see it bouncing around over about a, oh, let's call it a 20-foot range in here when things are going and maintaining average to above average conditions. But what we very clearly also see what happens when drought conditions occur. So here's our 2011 to 2016 decline. And there was a question earlier, how much have things bounced back? And so you can see the bounce back record here for this particular well. And you can see there've been other droughts in history. Here's the late 80s drought that ended up terminating in the early 90s and the recovery period associated with that. Okay, there were other droughts in time. But when we get pre-1970, we see that the hydrograph has a different form. It's very spiky. It's not like this over here where it bounces around when it gets to full. It's a very spiky situation. This is in part an effect of not having the wastewater effluent from Santa Clarita entering the system yet. So about this time frame, late 60s, early 70s, the wastewater treatment plants from Santa Clarita area began discharging their water into the Santa Clara River. That water came downstream and began percolating into the basins there and helped augment the supply in those basins. So what we see is a change in the way this hydrograph looks. And this is the more modern, current way it operates. In addition, about mid-1950s right here, Lake Piru came online, Santa Felicia Dam was completed, and so it began a program of adding water to the system. So we've got a way to see what happens to water levels in the basin, and we've got these hydrographs for a great many of the wells in the basin. And if you're interested in looking at some of those hydrographs, you can log on to the online database. And the link of that is on the agency's website. So I encourage you to go there, look around. You can click on a well and check out the hydrograph associated with it and look at some water quality data if we have it for that particular well. It's a nice tool to orient yourself and get you used to what's going on in the basin. So if we're looking at what was the effect of the last drought, yes.
Sorry, Tony, I was before you leave that slide. There's just a question on this graph. What is feet or FTAMSL? What does that stand for?
Above mean sea level. Feet above mean sea level. Standard way to identify your elevation. So we can take a look at this particular hydrograph, and from it, we can assess what the effects were of the most recent drought. So from 2011 to 2016, we had about a 70-foot decline. And that 70-foot decline occurred over about a five-year time window. And so we could go through every single well, every single hydrograph we have in the basin, and determine how much of decline over how many years that took place, and begin to get a feel for what groundwater storage change might be. Or we can go back to this map that you've seen earlier, which is the water level decline from 2011 to 2016, and use that differential there, that differential groundwater elevation in United's groundwater flow model that they're preparing. And that model will integrate that across both basins and be able to tell us what the change in storage is based on these water level declines that have been recorded in these various wells across the basin. So the model's gonna be very helpful to us to calculate change in storage. We'll be able to separate out Fillmore Basin versus Piru Basin, et cetera. Changes in storage over areas within the basins. If you wanna look at the rising groundwater at the basin boundaries and look and, you know, carve out a little piece of it and say, what were the water budgets? What were the change in storage look like in these particular areas? And so we can estimate what level of groundwater change would be necessary. Let me rephrase that. What groundwater elevation would be necessary to maintain if we wanted to survive another drought like the 2011 to 2016 drought, for example, and not have any reduction in groundwater extraction rates? So we'd be able to do that once we get the model to that point. So I wanted to just let you know that this storage and elevation are very much linked together, and it's going to make heavy use of the groundwater model. It's an excellent tool for us to be able to tease out a lot of information about what's going on in the basin and to play what if games in the future with what happens if we have more rainfall, less rainfall. What if we don't get as much effluent in the Santa Clara River from the upstream folks as we have in the past? What will that do to the groundwater elevations in the basin and all the other sustainable management indicators that we have? So I mentioned that we weren't going to get through all of the indicators tonight, but I wanted to throw out some ideas on example, possible other undesirable results that people could be thinking about. And so I put in the one that says groundwater levels declining below the top of the well screen, just to give you a flavor of how this works out. We haven't defined metrics, although it's likely to be groundwater elevation for this one. We haven't defined the MTs or the MOs associated with that. The groundwater storage is the one we talked about before, inadequate storage to last through a multi-year drought without groundwater extraction limitations. But if we go down to the other ones, we haven't talked about those at all this evening, just for time's sake purposes, but we're talking and brainstorming on a lot of things. So some things have been tossed out about maybe for surface water depletion. Like I said before, we don't have a lot of surface water flow in the Santa Clara River, for example, over most of the year. It's dry. Some of the tributaries have water in them, Sespe, maybe Pirate Creek on certain reaches, but not the Santa Clara River. And so we've been thinking of maybe one way to do that would be to look at groundwater elevations associated with a surrogate. So maybe we use the rooting depths of groundwater dependent vegetation communities as a way to say, if there's declines in groundwater elevations associated in the vicinity of these GDE communities, then maybe we can use that as a surrogate to talk about what kind of surface water depletion we're talking about. Remember, all of these parameters are based on whatever action this agency takes in its management plan, in its groundwater sustainability plan. So is the plan, are the new projects, if there are any, are the pumping scenarios that are outlaid looking to create significant and unreasonable surface water depletion? So it's really tied to the conditions in the basin and what the sustainable groundwater management plan might look like. So we took land subsidence as a general category as well. So land subsidence amounts that interfere with infrastructure operations. That's a nice generic descriptor of an undesirable result. But if we're going to use something like that, we've got to flesh out what is the metric going to be and what MT and what MO is going to be associated with that. Groundwater degradation is an interesting one. This agency does not have any authority over surface water. It can't regulate flows. It doesn't deal with flood flows. It isn't a surface water regulatory entity, and it isn't a groundwater regulatory entity either. There are others such as the Regional Water Quality Control Board, DTSC, the EPA, if you want to go to the federal level. They do have water quality authority. But this agency does not have water quality authority. So we have to think very carefully on how we would craft the metrics and the MTs for something where you don't really have control over what goes on with water quality degradation. The fuzzy part of that is if you write a GSP that does create a situation which does result in degradation as a direct result of the plan, then the agency might be on the hook for dealing with a way to deal with that. But if you're looking at ambient background, naturally occurring conditions that existed before the enactment of this legislation, then this agency doesn't have much authority to adjust groundwater quality. We can say, with a big smile on our faces, that we are not particularly interested in talking about seawater intrusion in this basin because we're so far from the coast and at an elevation well above sea level that it's largely a not applicable situation for us here. So we can check that one off pretty quickly. So this list here is not cast in stone by any stretch of the imaginations. It's me sitting there and putting in some words that, so if you don't like these, that's fine. Let's come up with some new ideas on what the possible undesirable results might be and bounce around some thoughts on what a metric or an MT or an MO might look for that. So my intent was to get done relatively quickly here so we had plenty of time for questions. So I appreciate your time and attention, and I'll pass it back to our host.
We do have one question in the question box. It seems like the GDE plant communities should be considered under the groundwater elevation criterion instead of surface water depletion. Can you please explain why it is listed under surface water depletion? Groundwater levels below the root zone would, by definition, mean complete depletion of interconnected surface water.
No, that's true. You could put that under GDE plant communities under groundwater elevation as well. And so the interesting thing that everyone has to keep in mind is that many of these sustainability indicators are interrelated. So we've talked a bit about elevation and storage reduction being based on elevation. So we're thinking that it may be appropriate to use the change in groundwater elevation near GDE communities as an indicator that there was a disruption or a reduction in the surface water and groundwater interaction status there. So I think we're getting at the same thing, just saying it differently.
Okay, and then one more. Once we choose our SMC factors and then decide we would like to change or drop one for another, can we?
Yes, at a grand scale, SGMA requires you to update your sustainable management plan, your GSP, every 5 years. That's required. You can update it more frequently than that if there's a compelling reason where you think you need to. But even during this period when we're evaluating and running various scenarios for future conditions, for example, and if we find that the MT that we've picked for a particular indicator is too restrictive or not restrictive enough, we can come back and change that prior to submitting the GSP. So just if we were to make a decision tonight, for example, we don't have to stick with that. We can change our minds in a month and say, we found a better way to do this. We found a better MT or a better MO or a better way to craft the undesirable result description. So we're not bound to it right now. There is a point in time coming, and we'll talk about that later in the schedule part of the presentations, where we're going to have to make some decisions on what we're going to put in this version of the groundwater sustainability plan that's due in January 2022.
Great. Another question. And is there an elevation defined to maintain at the Santa Paula Basin boundary?
Right now, there is not an elevation defined for that. Interesting enough, the Santa Paula Basin is an adjudicated basin, and so they are exempt from the majority of the requirements of SGMA. They do not have to prepare a groundwater sustainability plan. They do have to turn in annual reports to DWR about what the status of their basin is, but they don't have to do a GSP or any annual reporting on the sustainability criteria in their basin. So interesting, the Santa Paula Fillmore Basin boundary is an area with significant rising groundwater there. So there's shallow groundwater there through much of the year. And it's an area where groundwater levels don't fluctuate very much. You saw on one of the maps tonight that I think it was in the 20-foot range for water level changes at the Fillmore Santa Paula Basin boundary during the drought. So it's an area where we have the rising groundwater, and so that sort of mitigates or at least mutes the groundwater changes that are elevation changes that occur there.
So we don't have any questions right now, but I'm wondering, Director McFadden has his hand up.
I just wanted to add. Thank you. The ad hoc committee that's been wrestling with this, I think we've had 6 or 7 meetings, and we've had a very healthy discussion, polite but heated, unlike recent debates. But we still have a long way to go, and we haven't made recommendations to the board, and the board has not made decisions as far as SMCs mm-hmm. that we want to adopt. So as Tony Morgan said earlier, this is a real meaty part of the tasks that we have to do to comply with SGMA. So We're spending a lot of time with it. We're taking it very seriously because it has a lot of long-term repercussions for how we move forward in the future. That's all, Lisa.
There's one more question in the chat box, and then I was thinking that perhaps we can put up some of the slides with the potential examples and see if we can get some initial reactions or responses to those, maybe potential additional suggestions. But let me get through the one question that was in the chat, and then I see 2 more in the Q&A. So the question is, groundwater depletion seems to be least at the river. Can natural floodplain protection and expansion be part of the solution to infiltrate water to the aquifer?
The short answer is yes. It can be part of it. And in many areas around the country, well, around the world, actively managing floodplains to allow surface water flood flows, if you will, to go off channel and to percolate into the ground, it's a very tried and true procedure. So yes, it could be a future project. Obviously in coordination with Ventura County Flood Control, et cetera, Corps of Engineers, there'd be a lot of folks who want to weigh in on that.
I think is the impact of land subsidence on groundwater total storage not projected to be a significant issue for these basins?
We've not finished all of our assessment of land subsidence yet, but in reality, we don't think it's a very significant factor, and we don't think land subsidence is going to be a big storage change factor that we need to get concerned about. Remember, the storage change in this instance is compressing of the fine grain sediments that are within the aquifer or bounding the aquifer, for example. And so there's some storage change associated with those, but that's not where the predominant amount of your groundwater comes from. It comes from the coarse grain aquifers there. So we're not thinking that subsidence is an overly big issue. We got to finish our evaluations of it and get to some thoughts on what our undesirable result and MT might look like, and we can get back to you with some more detail.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Have you evaluated sea level rise models to ensure there's no chance of saltwater intrusion? I thought I saw a model that showed fluvial effects that traveled close to the diversion. May not be an issue, but just thought I would throw it out there.
I don't know that we've looked at all seawater rise models out there, but we're well above it elevation-wise. So I think there's zero potential for seawater intrusion to be a factor in these two basins, where elevation is quite a bit higher than sea level here.
Okay. And then the last question we have for now is, who is on the ad hoc committee for the basins? And that is Director McFadden, Director Pace, and Director Menigan, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in fact, I was just gonna ask that we introduce that group and what they're working on so that people understand. Ed, do you wanna describe it or?
Sure, I'll jump in. Lisa mentioned the members of that particular ad hoc committee, myself, Glenn Pace, Candace Menigan. And we've been going through looking at matrices similar to what you've seen on the screen in the presentation from Tony Morgan, and just trying to just brainstorm every possible scenario, looking at undesirable results, the MTs, the MOs, and trying to reach a consensus on these factors that we can present to the board. And I'll ask the other ad hoc committee members if they want to add anything else to that.
Hi. So I think the only thing to add right now is we're sharing what our thinking has been so far. We didn't want to get too ahead of ourselves because it's important to get feedback from stakeholders. What I think folks should also keep in mind is that when we are thinking about sustainability, we're looking at what the beneficial uses and users are. And so when it comes to our undesirable results, that might be, you know, there might be an undesirable result for one species that's, you know, federally or state endangered that will be required. But then there might be a undesirable result for vegetation communities that's different. And so the minimum thresholds and measurable objectives are really tied to who your beneficial users and uses are. And so those can also vary where you have minimum thresholds at particular times of the year. And it can also vary that you have minimum thresholds in particular parts of the basin. And that's kind of to Tony Morgan's point earlier, is that in areas where we know there is rising groundwater and there's definitely an interaction between surface water and groundwater, and we have groundwater dependent ecosystems, you're gonna have metrics and objectives in those areas where you might not have metrics and objectives in other areas, because those are important areas within the basins. And so you got to think of it a little bit from a temporal and spatial point of view, and also for your different uses and users.
Well, and to also follow up so that everyone knows, we have United Water, which is municipal uses. We have pumpers, agriculture uses. We have environmental interests. So we're looking at the full gambit of what DWR is requesting us or demanding of us to do. And so we have to fill the requirements of SGMA when we're looking at these. So I just want to make sure people know that, if we're not favoring one group or another. We have to follow the rules of DWR and SGMA as to how we come up with these criteria. And we also have to have the stakeholder engagement. So just because we have a subcommittee that is creating or coming up with some ideas, we have to vet this through the system and through our stakeholders to ensure there is buy-in and that it is correct. Glenn, do you want to say anything else?
I think I would just add that one of the big things that we have is a time constraint, I guess, as we're moving forward. We have found, as Dr. McFadden had mentioned, we've met multiple times, and we think we've had some great discussions, and we've had some great ideas, and we think we're, you know, progressing positively, but we really can't do it on our own. This is just from ideas and trying to put ourselves in a position to be able to move this forward. But the reality is we're required to have stakeholder input. And we as directors represent some stakeholders, and we do have feedback from our organization, but clearly it's not everyone. And so we need to get that input, and we'll be working on ways of trying to get more input from the stakeholders. This was just one night to try to introduce what we need and how we're going to come about it. And we'll be reaching out to each of you to try to have that input, but we also hope that the stakeholders will reach out to us and provide that their input and take an active role on that. Because of the timing situation, we don't have a long time. This isn't like a year that we're discussing it. We need to be pulling these numbers together, I believe, Tony can correct me, in the next couple of months to try to put these criteria, these undesirable results and stuff together, is my understanding, so we can move the plan forward. Is that a fair statement, Tony?
Yes, it is.
And so also, after we show the information, if you have any follow-up questions, you can email that to Eva Ibarra at evai@unitedwater.org. That's evai@unitedwater.org. And we will give all that. And then Lisa will also put both that her email and Lisa's email in it, just to make sure that we capture it for people. Okay.
There's one more question in the chat box.
Go ahead.
Will the plan include contingencies such as even more extremes, such as watershed flow changes due to extreme denudation from fire, lack of snowmelt, and subsidence from seismic events?
The short answer is no. It's not planned to go to that level of extreme condition. I mean, the lack of snowmelt doesn't affect us directly here. Subsidence from seismic events, no, that's not envisioned to be an issue that we're going to try to tackle. And we're all living with fire on a daily basis, it seems like, in this state, but we're not talking about trying to model what the effects of fire would be on hill slope runoff and that kind of thing. That's beyond the scope of what we've got envisioned for this groundwater sustainability plan.
But Tony, I think you should talk a little bit to the fact that we do have to address future conditions in the plan. And so we are looking at climate change and changes to inflows of water and so forth.
I can elaborate on that a little bit more. We have that 50-year period. Remember, we've got 20 years to come into compliance and to show that we're sustainable. And then we've got another 30-year period beyond that. So we're trying to forecast out 50 years into the future. And so we're looking for input from DWR on climate, and they've given us scenarios that we can use as part of our GSP development process. So we'll take United's groundwater flow model, we'll alter precipitation, et cetera, in that flow model and see what the effects are. And so we can quantify what we think might happen with respect to climate change. We're also querying the cities of Fillmore and the town of Piru about expansion. What's going on there in the way of additional housing and more groundwater demand? Because most everybody is using groundwater for their supplies. And so it's going to be a new source of demand on the groundwater resources in the basin. So we're looking to those entities to give us feedback on what does it look like in the future. And I realize, you know, we're talking about going out 50 years, and we're talking about climate change and a whole bunch of things. And, you know, sometimes we have trouble predicting the weather 3 weeks in advance. So when we're talking about looking out 50 years, you know, we're pushing the envelope. But we have some guidance from DWRs to what they would like to see in the GSPs with respect to that. But we know that urban water management plans, for example, that are prepared by the city of Fillmore have information on what they think might happen to their population and their water demand over the next series of years. And so we're thinking we're going to roll some of those change factors into the groundwater modeling. And so when we look into the future, and if for example, Fillmore says, hey, we should plan on a 2% increase in population, which equates to this much more water demand for the next 20 years, and then 1% thereafter. I'm making up numbers right now for conversation. We'll put that into the groundwater flow model and turn the crank and see what that does to affect groundwater elevations and storage within the two basins. We're talking to both Fillmore and the county on their wastewater treatment plants. Are you going to continue to deal with wastewater in the current way that you are right now? Do you have any plans for big recycling efforts where some of that water that used to go into their infiltration ponds and get percolated into the subsurface might instead be routed back to the city and be used for purposes such as irrigating parks and ball fields and medians along roads and things like that, which are typical uses for recycled water. And so we're getting information from them so we can factor that into the groundwater flow model as well. So again, it's all towards looking at that 50-year timeline and making sure that we can, to the very best of our abilities right now, put forth a plan that says we can be sustainable, we can achieve sustainability in 20 years, and we can maintain it for another 30.
So I think we don't have any more questions. I'm sorry.
I was going to say one thing to add on that is because they're unknowns, that's one of the reasons that DWR requires that we revisit the plan every 5 years during the future period. Mm-hmm. So we have a do-over chance on a regular basis to include something that maybe we missed or to tweak something.
Right.
And then
is there intended to be living plants? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna state the reason why we're not a medium basin for both of them, that we're a higher priority is not because of the condition of the basins currently, but it is the, maybe we have more people or things change in our basins, and that's why we're put in a higher priority. I think that's important for our stakeholders to understand as well.
And I also think DWR weighs the fact that our primary source of water supply is groundwater. So that kind of gives us extra points and pushes us into the higher category.
Okay, so I think we've done a really good job of explaining why we have to do these criteria. Maybe we should move now into it. I know we're supposed to be done on this one at 7:45. So I'm not going to rush this. I just want to let the time. Go ahead, Lisa.
To that point, I thought it might be worthwhile, Tony, if you can put up the slides that have the matrices with the three potential criteria on elevation and then the overall slide, and maybe put that up for people to look and see if we can get some initial responses. Now that we've answered all the questions, maybe we can get some input, some initial feedback to those potential criteria.
Is that the slide you initially wanted to see, Lisa?
The slide with the matrices partially filled in. I thought people could take a look at that a little more and let us know.
Okay.
The potential example.
There we go.
Your screen isn't shared.
Can you share your screen, Tony?
Did it drop me? Get it?
We just thought, yeah, there's this one, and there's also the three options for groundwater elevation, and just we really want to get some initial reaction and response to this. If anybody's got any thoughts now, can raise your hand or put something in the chat. And I will also put Eva's email in the chat box if you want to, you know, think about this a little bit further. But the committee and the board is really looking to get some initial feedback on these as it continues its deliberations. And there will be further opportunities to weigh in on these as they're presented, you know, to the board at future board meetings and the like. So I'm not seeing anybody with their hands up or anything in the chat, which is fine. Just wanted to give the opportunity, especially since we had a few more minutes. Oh, here we've got one. A suggestion to add water quality availability of riparian forest.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I said water quality. I just meant to say water availability.
Water availability. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
You want to go back to the one that has the three options for groundwater elevation for just a moment? See if anybody's got any thoughts on these three options.
Even if it's something totally different.
Or any additional options. Oh, here's one. Let's see. Once the metric, oh, here's a question. Once the metric is chosen, how do you measure when wells are all different?
Help me a little bit with that question. Are you meaning the wells are different because they're different depths? So if we choose a metric for groundwater elevation to be, you know, the depth of water, okay, but that's okay. The wells will be different depending on their depth and depending on, response pop up there.
To your question.
So Tony, integrate those together. Yes.
We would, for one thing, we would probably use monitoring wells, not privately owned wells. Presumably, because in order to maintain the longevity, if we say a criterion is the water level, is this water level, it would be in a monitoring well that would last over a long period of time, not a privately owned well.
In a perfect world, I think that would be a great thing to do. Unfortunately, if we don't have a whole lot of monitoring wells constructed so that they are perforated in only one aquifer or one aquifer zone, as we might have them defined. And so we try to make use of as many of the existing wells as possible. And we like to use those wells that have a long-term record associated with them. So we can, you know, keep a hold of that historical trend there. It may be something that this agency wants to consider in the future. If someone has a well that we've been monitoring and we think that there's a chance they're going to drill a new well for whatever reason, it may be advantageous for the agency to say, we will take over monitoring on that well and enable that well to still survive and not be destroyed for the county codes because it's a critical monitoring point in your system. So monitoring wells would be great, but if we're trying to monitor shallow aquifers, deeper aquifers, that could mean the construction of quite a few wells. And so that's why we try to the extent possible, make use of existing wells.
Okay, thanks. Another question. With projections from climate change saying the storms will be more intense and the rain season will be shorter, and from what I have read, the amount of rain in the water year will be close to the same, how is the GSA looking at finding ways to capture more water?
at this point in time, we're still in the process of using United's groundwater model to do those forward forecasting efforts and to see what that might look like. How much extra water are we going to get? And I mean extra water, I don't mean that in the standpoint that the amount of rainfall in the year is going to increase. It means it's going to fall on fewer days during the year. So it's likely to be more intensive, maybe more runoff and flashier responses in the stream. And so if there's a way to capture some of that water, I think that's a viable mechanism. One of the things that the agency will do here is, depending on the MTs and MOs and the undesirable results that we select, we will look out for the 50-year period into the future and say, do we really need to do projects? Are we okay, even with climate change and that kind of thing, are we okay without doing projects? And if we are, awesome. If we think there's a way we want to periodically top off the basin, maybe this is something where we talk and work out something with flood control, Corps of Engineers, et cetera, where we do a little what's called flood mar kind of approach, where we flood some territory or some lands adjacent to the river and use that as an impromptu spreading basin to get additional waters into the ground. So the agency hasn't gone through any evaluation process yet because we haven't determined that we really need to.
Great, thanks. I'm going to take the questions a little out of order. The next one is, I'm curious to hear Candace's thoughts. I am still wrapping my head around this topic.
So Abby, are you referring to groundwater dependent ecosystems with regards to surface water and groundwater elevation? I'm a little unclear on what you want.
And this, you're kind of soft. Maybe speak a little louder.
I was saying, I was just trying to clarify with Abby what she was asking. So the Nature Conservancy came out with a framework which provided guidance for groundwater dependent ecosystems. And the example that we provided for surface water and groundwater interactions was the rooting depth. So Daniel B. Stevens is actually subcontracted with Stillwater Sciences. And one of our sustainable management criteria ad hoc meetings was Stillwater Sciences. And so with regards to riparian vegetation, and we're looking at potentially a willow species and the rooting depth for those, right? But back to my point about, well, there are other species. A lot of birds are dependent on these vegetative communities. So by protecting the vegetation communities, you're also protecting the nesting habitat for birds. As Ed had pointed out, we've also had some back and forth on other management criteria, but those are by no means finalized within the ad hoc committee, and we didn't feel ready to bring those to the group. But, you know, to my point earlier about endangered species, we do also have steelhead, so we do have to identify undesirable results for steelhead. And we have had some preliminary discussions with Stillwater Sciences about that. The Nature Conservancy's guidance is to say that we need to also coordinate with the National Marine Fisheries Service on that. So, you know, regulatory agencies that we also need to reach out to get further input and guidance. The Department of Water Resources is also meant to provide best management practice and guidance with regards to groundwater dependent ecosystems. I've been participating in a statewide groundwater collaborative, and we have posed the question to the Department of Water Resources because that guidance was not provided for the groundwater sustainability plans that were submitted earlier this year. And a lot of those plans have been evaluated, and a lot of them haven't adequately addressed groundwater dependent ecosystems, and we're asking for that guidance. I've gone so far as to offer our basins as a pilot to provide the development of that criteria and guidance, but you know, in the absence of that, this is also why, and back to the point of local control, we are trying to get stakeholder input to also help guide the development of that criteria. And so I do convene a broader Santa Clara River groundwater environmental collaborative, and that's just to bring environmental stakeholders and groups together to kind of have these discussions on a more collective and comprehensive watershed wide scale, because obviously species don't know groundwater sustainability agency boundaries. But that said, the basins are also different and the conditions are also different in different basins across the landscape. And so there will be consistency across the landscape with regards to species needs, but those will also be different dependent on the groundwater dependent ecosystems that we identify. I don't know if that helps or answers your question.
Thank you.
Okay. Another question is, the historical groundwater levels last century looked significantly lower than 2016 levels. Given this, please explain why the discussion of SMC for groundwater levels is focusing on 2016 levels. Do we know if there were significant and unreasonable effects at the lower historical levels?
Yeah, the discussions this evening were focused on the most recent drought. It was a severe drought. It's one that's in people's minds. They remember it. They know what the effects were, how it impacted their operations. And so there's a good linkage between the conditions that happened, the impacts that occurred, and the severity of the drought. If we go back further in time, pre-1980 or so, we have much fewer groundwater level data sets to work with. We know from some of those wells, and one of them I showed tonight, did have varied fluctuations in there. But the system that we have working now with Lake Piru there and releases coming out of Castaic periodically for downstream users is much different than what it was in the past. And so to try to go backwards and compare what the effects were in 1950, I think that's a pretty tough nut to crack just because of the absence of a lot of information. A lot of groundwater data is missing.
Tony, isn't it also we are following the guidelines that DWR has provided into when to be setting the date or what's the marker? Well,
yeah, I mean, we can per the regulations. We don't have to go back and quote, fix conditions that existed prior to 2015 when the regulations came online. So we don't have to go back and do that. We can if we want. But I appreciate the question and saying, well, the conditions look different. There might have been more severe droughts in the past, and that's correct. There might have been. But the amount of data we have to quantify that isn't as extensive as I would like to have for this kind of planning effort. And the system that we're dealing with, the presence of Lake Piru and its operations, as well as upstream effluent coming down from Santa Clarita area, that puts a different spin on the hydrology of these two basins.
My only comment was meaning the fact that we are following that. We could go way back to 150 years, but there's actual markers in which the DWR has specified for us. So we're following those guidelines is what I was trying to get at.
Okay.
So the last thing here is, will these two basins always be done during the same workshop, or at some point will they be done separately? I believe they will each have their own GSP, meaning the Piru and Fillmore Basin. And yet they will each have their own GSP, and the way we've planned these workshops is to have them together until the point where a separate GSP is written for each, and then we would likely have a separate workshop for each. But we're happy to take any input and suggestions if you feel that we might want to separate them earlier for any other reasons. Mm-hmm. So I think that's it. This was really helpful. I'm glad we got a little more discussion on these. And again, please feel free to give us further input and comments as we, do we get one more? Oh, a big howdy. Debbie, yeah. Ed, and Gordon. Thanks. As we proceed. So.
Hand raised for a comment.
Oh, sorry, I wasn't sure this wasn't put down from before. Go ahead, Ed.
There was a question earlier about rainwater collection, and I just wanted to mention that both of the basins benefit from a really amazing facility for collecting rainwater, and that's the Santa Felicia Dam on Lake Piru. So we have a very unusual situation in that way. When rainwater is collected, other water is collected, released, and we benefit from it. So keep that in mind too.
Super. Okay, with that, I feel like we're ready to, there's one more question in the Q&A. just a thing to you, Larry. Okay, great. I think we're ready to move on to the financial budget and schedule update, unless anybody else has anything else.
Lisa, I believe there was one question in the chat that maybe we didn't address.
Oh, thanks. Which one? We had the suggesting adding water availability of riparian forest. There's a second part maybe I didn't get to, sustainability of any known historic flow levels of streams, including during wet and dry season. Was that the one?
Yeah, that was the one. I think there was an addition to it. So I don't know if we
need to think about that. The second part, I think I might have missed. I'm not sure. It says sustainability of any known historic flow levels of streams, including during wet and dry season. I'm not sure.
If it's a suggestion to add that, that's fine. We can certainly factor that in.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, and two more questions have popped up. The implication of using the 2011 to 2017 drought is that extraordinary action would be taken if we have a worse drought. It's asked as a question, so I'm not sure if it's a question or, and then maybe as a follow on, at what level would we need to take action to restrict pumping?
Okay, so the implication of using the most current drought, that's merely to show you what the effects were of that drought. That's all. And so the idea is that you went through a pretty rough drought there. There wasn't a lot in the way of negative impacts to the basin. Yeah, you lost some water out of storage. Okay, but that's coming back now. You didn't have a lot of wells dewater. You didn't have a lot of wells where the water levels dropped into the well screens. Okay. There was a minor number of those. And so the point was to say, even when you rode through that drought, the impacts were not very severe. It's up to you, the stakeholders and the directors, to say, at what point do we set the minimum threshold? If we said, do water levels decline another 20 feet, another 50 feet, is that now significant and unreasonable? And at that point, we do something differently. Maybe we talk about restricting pumping, but right now we're nowhere near having those kinds of conversations. We're talking about framing it up to let you, the stakeholders, understand how the system responded under a moderately severe drought condition and everybody continued to operate. Okay, what did that look like? How did that affect the system? And then we'll now take those kinds of similar magnitude droughts and roll them forward in the future where we have climate change, where we have maybe a little less effluent from the wastewater plants from Santa Clarita coming downriver because they're going to implement a recycling program. And so once we roll those in there, then we'll be able to get some more input on that.
Okay. We've got a question: at what level would we need to take action to restrict pumping? I'm not sure if you rolled that into the prior answer.
Yeah, it's basically that's not a decision that we've made. It's one that the stakeholders and the directors get to make. Your technical staff will help you decide what those impacts might look like. But right now, we're not talking about that at all. We're trying to get our hands around undesirable results and what a minimum threshold might look like.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I think we're ready to move on to financial budget and schedule update.
Can I just ask one more thing? I know these criterias can be very intimidating to some. And Tony, when would we ever be updating this once the plan is set and we have our two groundwater sustainable plans submitted to DWR? They have 2 years to approve it. But would we ever modify these criteria?
We can, of course. You can do it in your five-year update, but if there's something compelling that happens between those five-year updates, you can take it upon yourself to say, no, this is a significant enough change in our conditions in the basin. We want to do an update in year three instead of year five. We need to get started and get something changed. So yes, you can do changes. These are not cast in stone forever. They are meant to be, you know, I hate the phrase living documents, but that's because it's overused so much, but that's what these are. Your plans are going to evolve, and some people say mutate as they go along and become better refined as more information becomes available and you understand what those future conditions really are. Again, we're buffing up the crystal ball and looking out 50 years. And so once we actually have 5 years under our belt of that 50, well, we have a little bit more information with which to fine tune the GSP.
Thank you very much. I just want to make sure for everyone as we do this that we are moving together and it is a fluid motion. So thank you. So next up would be Tony Emmert with the financial budget and schedule update.
Tony, oh, he's doing it. Let's see. Share my screen.
Is it working?
I'm having a little trouble there.
Can Zach help you?
So is there a document you need to bring up, Tony?
Yes. I have it open and I am not seeing it when I'm looking at trying to share screen.
Maybe just share like a screen one or screen two and just bring it up on it afterwards. It'll hide all of the Zoom stuff.
Okay.
Perhaps I was, maybe we could switch and have Tony Morgan go over the project schedule while Tony Emmert's working on getting his presentation materials up.
If that's okay with you, Tony Emmert, we could do that. Okay. Tony Morgan, can you go over?
Mary, momentarily you should see a screen pop up.
Yes.
All right, so here's a project timeline for development of the groundwater sustainability plan. And you, it starts here in August and goes all the way out to the filing of the GSP in January 2022. And it actually could extend further to the left off the screen to show the previous work, but I truncated it just so it fits on the slide better. And so a lot of GSP analyses and things like that have been going on. So the major big deadlines that are coming up is a draft administrative GSP in the February timeframe, the public review draft GSP in the May timeframe, draft final to the board for their consideration of adoption in October, and that it being on the agenda for possible adoption in the November timeframe. So there's various workshops and things that go on. There's, you know, an opportunity here for stakeholder workshop on the GSP, the draft, public draft GSP. All these entries here in purple are TMs for technical memos on subsidence or water budget or GDEs or the monitoring program and data gaps analysis document, groundwater model documentation, et cetera. Those things are all going on and underway. Here we are today. So we can see groundwater model validation going on, future conditions modeling going on there. And so when Director Pace said that we do have a short fuse to get some of these SMCs nailed down, he's totally correct. We need to get those done so that we can do the analysis, so that we can do the modeling with those SMCs in mind and be able to pull it all together in time to integrate it into the administrative draft for the board's review. So there's a lot of things going on right now, and the sooner we can get the SMCs built into a package to get started with the analyses, the better off I will feel in meeting the schedule of getting the admin draft in February. We can always go through establishing our SMCs right now, do some analysis, do some modeling, look at the results. I think I said earlier, if we've been too conservative or too loose on some MT, we can adjust it, rerun the model, and adjust accordingly. But until we get that initial set of indicators with their undesirable results and metrics and MTs and all that thought through and ready to go for the first trial, we're gonna run into a time crunch in the not too distant future. So what I'm asking is for stakeholders, if you've got ideas, we're all ears. We're listening. Just feed us whatever kind of information, whatever thoughts you have, anything you've got to say, we will take seriously and look at it and see how it might fit into the overall program. Understand, we're not making the final decision. The ad hoc committee is not making the final decision. It's going to go to the full board, and obviously stakeholders have input along the way, excuse me, in what those sustainable management criteria will look like. So I just wanted you to see this schedule and understand that there's a lot of activity going on right now between the consultant team and United's modeling efforts, and it's all focal pointed on coming together for an admin draft of the GSP in the February timeframe. That's the most immediate major deadline.
Thanks, we've got one question on the schedule. The HCM basin setting and groundwater conditions information for the GSP is foundational for establishing SMC. It does not appear on the schedule that those items will be available while preparing the SMC. How will this lack of critical information for the SMC development process be addressed?
Well, a lot of the hydro conceptual modeling information will be a part of United's documentation for the groundwater flow model. That's an integral part of that there. And the other information on Basin conceptual, not Basin conceptual model, but settings and those kinds of things. We've got a bunch of information on that from all of the historic work that's been done in the basins there. And so that's something that's going to come out in, obviously, in the draft GSP, but will be a part of the documentation, I would imagine.
Thanks. No more questions, so we can switch it back to
there we go.
Okay. So, let's see. All right. Since I bought, yes.
We got the display flip with the notes view. So if you look at there, you got a display settings drop down right there. Switch that for us. Swap, yeah.
Yeah, there they are. Nope.
Although that looks like it. Yeah.
We got it. Okay. So our budget for an overview is based upon our planned activities. And for this agency, they're pretty straightforward. We're complying with SGMA. And our DSPs have to be submitted by January 2022, as Tony Morgan talked about a few minutes ago. One of our other objectives is to maximize our benefits of the $1.5 million grant that California Department of Water Resources awarded to us, and we are actively working to try to maximize the benefits of that. We have also been working to maximize the in-kind services that United Water has provided through its technical group, in particular the expansion of the regional groundwater model to the upstream basins, and that's moving along. And of course, we're trying to minimize costs to the stakeholders. So we, as was shared earlier by the directors, we don't want to plan on doing anything in a project or program until we see what those, what the forward-looking modeling says as far as good or bad results. And then we work on projects and programs from there. We're driven by the schedule. As Tony talked about, one of the primary activities has been extending the groundwater model to the Fillmore and Piru Basin. So the status of that, as you've heard, if you participated in past meetings, the calibration is completed. It is in validation. So a 3-year period that the validation is working. Documentation and peer review is in progress and should be available in the near future, and our next workshop will be focused much more on the model. I believe that's the time is still being set for that, but that's in the November, early December timeframe. Most of our major activities have been taking place on groundwater sustainability planning. There have been many technical memos. We will be preparing an administrative draft, as you saw by that schedule, and a public review draft is scheduled to be done by about the time that this current fiscal year finishes. So this part of our budget is plus or minus $400,000 between a little help from United staff and mostly the Daniel B. Stevens team. So that's how we're spending the bulk of the money in this fiscal year. If we look at also a major activity has been and continues to be stakeholder outreach. The costs for that are embedded in the Daniel B. Stevens contract, as well as some of the things that United does for meeting logistics. That's covered by the administrative part of our budget. and something that will be a major expense before we're done with the grant will be constructing hopefully several monitoring wells, and we are working on trying to determine the best places for those. And so we can close the priority data gaps, but those are not set yet. It looks like those may be focused on shallow water near the river that can give us some information that helps us manage that better. But the goals for this fiscal year ending at the end of June will be to get those well sited and to procure the easements and get the rough design done of those wells and procure a driller. And then that all adds up to about $200,000 that's in the budget. And then in the beginning of the very next fiscal year, starting in summer next year, would be to get those wells constructed. And hopefully we get all of those constructed before the end of the calendar year. So by December, all those could be constructed. We could get our invoices into DWR and get reimbursement on the way. So we have $200,000 budgeted for this year. We expect that the construction is going to be about $600,000. And if you recall, anybody who was part of our budget discussion, that cost has to be fronted by the agency. And then we are reimbursed after we submit those to DWR. So there's a several month lag in that. And so our plan includes looking for some short-term financing that would carry us over. So we have to pay our driller and we have to receive the invoices, and then we have to invoice DWR, and DWR will consider those and then reimburse us. So that's sort of the big picture plan on that. Our current groundwater charges are $12 an acre foot. The proposed fiscal year 21-22 is to remain at that level. And depending on whether we do projects or not, if we don't do any projects or programs that spend much money, then we could conceivably reduce the groundwater charges in the future. If we decide to do projects and programs, purchasing water, doing, you know, infiltration projects, et cetera, then of course the groundwater fees would be based upon that. The overall budget for the agency is about $1.2 million for the fiscal year. Roughly half of that is groundwater charges, and about half of that is reimbursements from the $1.5 million grant from DWR. And I think that's probably about it.
All right. Thank you, Tony, for covering that. We felt it was very important as a board that even though our stakeholder engagement is about our sustainable management criteria, it's always important for us to be reviewing the budget and what our next steps are. We want to make sure all of you stakeholders are engaged and know what's going on. We invite you to all of our board meetings and our workshops. We all are also available on email and through our website, which is the fpbgsa.org with that. So those will be our next steps. We'll be working on this criteria. Our subcommittee will be working on it again, and we'll be bringing it back to our board meetings. So that is what we'll be doing. We do have another poll we would like for you to participate in. And I didn't see any questions, so I'm gonna give that to Lisa to do. And also Ed McFadden would still be on the video, but his internet dropped him. So he's on voice only right now. So go ahead, Lisa.
Okay, thanks. Chair Long. So as we leave this meeting, we're just ask if you would participate in the poll that Zach is going to put up now. It's just for purposes of us being able to approve these workshops so that they meet your needs. And we're not going to put up the summary, so we just invite you to fill out the poll. And thank you again for coming. And just to also mention, this poll is anonymous. And please feel free to give us any additional comments or suggestions about this workshop via email as well. So have a good night. Thank you, everybody.
Lisa, can I ask, this poll that we're going to have done, will you present that to our next board meeting?
Sure, yeah. We'll also present it to the Stakeholder Engagement Ad Hoc Committee meeting that we have.
Okay, great.
As well.
I just wanted to say that in case any of the board members needed to leave, that they would be able to while we're finishing this up. There was one question. Oh.
Yeah, I didn't see that. Yeah.
There was a nice presentation. Tony, you are a PowerPoint wizard. Let that be put in the books.
Thank you, Tony, for your prep before the meeting, and Lisa and Tony. Everyone.
I will add PowerPoint wizard to my resume tomorrow.
Good job.
So, and then to Zach, there's a comment, inability to submit the poll.
I'm still here, but I'm not sure on what that is. I see that I have 11 of 13 voted.
Okay.
I got 12 of 13. So we would have got 100% participation.
Scroll down. Somebody suggested to scroll down. Perhaps they're not seeing the submit button.
There are 5 questions there. Well, there we go. They must have got it. We got 13 of 13 there.
Okay.
Okay, super. Thank you, everybody. Have a nice night.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good night.
Have a good night. Thank you.
Good night. Good night.